Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning, this Wednesday, January 15th, 2020, and Happy New Year from The Ballot Box, a show sponsored by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle and brought to you by Vox Populi, the voice of the people of Westchester and its environs, otherwise known to radio listeners as WVOX in New Rochelle, New York. I'm Nina Lubin, my co-host is Tamar Tate, and it bears repeating that we're on the air courtesy of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, the League, a nonpartisan organization dedicated for the last 100 years, folks. That's one full century of educating citizens about their rights as citizens. Formed in 1920, here we are in 2020. Tamar, how are you this morning?
I'm good, Nina. Thanks so much. I hope you had a nice holiday. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. We certainly did. Entered 2020 in reasonable good health and good cheer and grateful for it.
Happy to hear it, although it's hard to believe it's January when you look outside today with this beautiful weather. It's great to be here in the studio with you for another hour of The Ballot Box. You know, last year was an exceptional way legislatively. The sheer volume of bills that passed both houses in New York State, especially those affecting elections and campaign finance, hasn't been seen in decades. And today, we're going to focus a little bit on New York's public campaign financing system. And to help us understand that issue, we're going to be speaking with Sochi Nimaka, the new state director of the Working Families Party. First, though, Nina, I know you have some quick updates from Albany for us. Voter news roundup.
Yes. Voters are truly at the heart of this news. On January 9th, the New York State Senate passed a voting reform package designed to remove barriers to voting and increase voter turnout. There are estimates, Tamar, that New York has somewhere between 1 and 2 million individuals who are eligible to vote but are not on the voter rolls. This reform package is attempting to remedy this and includes bills that, among other things, will bring electronic voter registration into agencies like the Department of Motor Vehicles and the Department of Health that automatically enrolls eligible voters unless they opt out. The package includes bills that add polling places on college and university campuses. It designates more funding for early voting and ensures that in high population municipalities, there'll be at least one polling place designated for early voting. These are significant rollouts from the Democratic Majority State Senate.
Interesting new developments, Nina.
Yeah, for the record, Senate Republicans view automatic voter registration with concern, saying it deprives individuals of certain rights and that it doesn't go far enough to prevent the registration of undocumented aliens. The whole package moves to the Assembly for approval, and if it's signed into law, it'll take effect in 2 years.
Okay, we need to keep our eyes on that, and hopefully we'll have an update next month. Moving to our focus today, by way of a quick background, new plan for using public money to fund campaigns in New York is moving forward. The New York State Commission on Public Finance Reform, which is a commission of political appointees, has developed a system to spend up to $100 million in public funds on elections, and lawmakers had until Sunday, December 24th, while we were all running around doing our Christmas shopping, our holiday shopping, they were supposed to return for a rare special session to outright reject the plan, which they didn't do. So as a result, the plan's moving forward. And under the plan as currently presented, New Yorkers who give $250 or less are going to see their donations matched with public funds 6-to-1 for statewide office candidates such as governor. What that means is a $100 donation would be worth $700 to a candidate. Donations to local candidates would also be matched 12-to-1 for the first $50, 9-to-1 for the next $100, and 8-to-1 for the final $100. Candidates will face limits of $5,000 per donor for assembly races, $10,000 per donor for Senate races, down from about 9,000 and 19,000. So New York State's campaign finance limits are the highest in the country, and federal presidential candidates can raise $5,600 from a single donor.
So our New York State candidates have higher limits than the president does. Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of limits, the donor limit, this is a big one for gubernatorial candidates in New York, went down from almost $70,000 to $18,000. That is a huge change in the limit, but in the eyes of some, may not be low enough.
Well, there are a lot of people who have a lot to say about this plan. It's drawn scrutiny from many sides, and lawmakers are expected to really fine-tune the details next year to make changes. The Fair Elections for New York campaign was especially critical of the plan. It said, and I'm quoting here, it said, "Evidence suggests the Public Campaign Financing Commission was what the cynics had alleged, a public face for a backroom deal struck between the governor and legislative leaders." Whoa, that's...
Tell us what you really feel.
They are not happy with this plan. So it's going to be interesting to hear our guest's take on this.
Yes, especially since smaller political parties such as the Working Families Party say that the new plan could seriously affect their viability in New York because the plan drastically raises the threshold for the number of votes parties need to get on the ballot. So without further ado, let's bring our guest into the conversation. On the line is Sochi Nemeka, State Director of the New York Working Families Party. Sochi, the daughter of Nigerian immigrant parents, is a graduate of Yale University and Georgetown Law School. She has spent a goodly portion of her adult and young adult life active in the progressive movement. She's a seasoned community, union, and political organizer whose efforts have borne significant results, particularly in New Haven, which I'm going to ask her to describe a bit for us in a moment. Sochi has recently assumed the role and responsibilities of State Director of the New York Working Families Party, where she will continue a career dedicated to building power for working people. Sochi, I hope you're there. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the ballot box.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to talk with you today.
This is the first time we're speaking. We've had extensive email correspondence. Email has its limitations. So first, let me make sure we have the correct pronunciation of your name. Is it Nemeka?
That's correct. You did excellently. Thank you.
Thank you. Tamar and I have been experimenting. Glad we're close, Nemeka. So, Sochi, which we will call you, Sochi, congratulations on your new position. We have questions about the Working Families Party in general, as well as about the new public campaign finance law, which we'll focus on. But first, if you don't mind, a little getting to know you for Tamar and myself and for our listeners. Would you tell us a bit about your background, including your impressive work in New Haven, and how you think it may have prepared you for your new position?
Great, wonderful. Well, thank you. I'm really happy to have the opportunity to chat with you all, share a little bit about myself. So I was born and raised in New York State, in New Rochelle, actually, not too far from the studio. My parents settled in New York in the 70s from Nigeria, as you mentioned. And I spent a lot of my time kind of really searching for belonging. I think it's a kind of classic story of immigrant children or children of immigrants figuring out what is your role in this country? What is your relationship to civic participation? Is this country calling on you to serve and in which form? And I think it was really through organizing that I found a real deep sense of purpose, that I felt most at home in solidarity-based struggle and working with working people from church basements to front porches to union halls, where people are really actively imagining, dreaming, and fighting for a vision of this country that has space for them and that operates under an agenda that works for them. And so my work has taken me from Miami, Florida, where I organized hospitality workers, to Toledo, Ohio, where I worked with on the presidential campaign in 2008 for Barack Obama and really learned the value of creating strong teams and a strong sense of ownership for individuals in a campaign. And New Haven, Connecticut, where there's a very strong labor movement in a city with a very strong employer university, and where I went to school, and where I saw an active and healthy power struggle between union workers and the Yale administration to shape a vision for a city that worked for everyone, where workers had decent wages and their kids went to good schools. And they did not have fights with their landlords and face eviction, right? So we were fighting not only for wages, but for an inclusive democracy. And the union floor, the shop floor, was a site for that. We transformed that shop floor energy into electoral victories and ran a whole slate of workers from the union and from other community organizations, grassroots allied organizations, to take over the city council in New Haven and to really reshape the Democratic Party in New Haven to put forward an agenda of good jobs, of safe streets, of youth programming. So I really saw the ability to put working people first, to have them lead and have them govern in a way that has reverberations beyond their workplaces.
Hi, it's Tamar. How are you?
Hi, Tamar. Well, how are you doing?
Good. We're so glad to have you on the show. I'm wondering, obviously, you have such an amazingly impressive background, which seems to align with the goals of the Working Families Party, which is where you find yourself at this moment. Congratulations on the new position. I'm wondering, the Working Party Families Party has been around for about 20 years now. Maybe you can explain its policy goals within New York State. A lot of our listeners might not be familiar with it. And maybe you can also speak to its priorities going into the 2020 elections.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah, so the Working Families Party was founded in New York State.
I'm going to ask you if we could just resume this after our commercial break, and then we can go into further detail.
Perfect. Talk to you
then. All right. Thank you.
Take heart, White Plains and Central Westchester. Now that another local radio voice of many years has completely given up the local focus and abandoned any and all hometown programming, there is only one remaining local voice. Welcome to WVOX and WVOX.com. America's great community station, live and Westchester local, for you and yours. No cookie-cutter, piped-in, syndicated, one-size-fits-all corporate program. There's always something happening on WVOX and WVOX.com. Now, Westchester's only local station. We're glad to be of service to White Plains, Greenburg, and Mount Vernon, too. It was only a matter of time.
1460 WVOX.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, welcome back to the Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate. I'm here with Nita Lubin, my co-host, and we are interviewing Soshi Nemeka, who is the New York State Director of the Working Families Party. Hi, Soshi.
Hi.
Welcome back. So we were just about to discuss the Working Families Party and its policy goals and its priorities going forward.
Yeah. So as folks may know, the Working Families Party has been in New York for over 21 years now and has really been an engine of people power in New York State, both electoral and legislative, right? We think about our elections as electing properly progressive working families champions and creating the conditions for strong legislation that creates meaningful changes in the lives of working families, from paid sick leave to increasing the minimum wage to what we saw as the real sweep of legislative victories in this last cycle. last year or 2 years ago, the Working Families Party was critical in defeating the IDC, right, the Independent Democratic Caucus in the state legislature. Group that we saw is really a concentrated form of the interests of the corporate wings of the Democratic Party that made it really difficult for us to legislate on a vision of the many, right? We conserve a party of the many, not the few. We engage in non-delusional, right, third-party strategy to make sure that we have an agenda that wins and people are not spoiling or wasting their votes, right? Voters are not wasting their votes when they support us on the Working Families Party line. And so in the past 2 years alone, we've managed to end the IDC, thus flipping the state Senate and delivering a properly Democratic majority, electing Jumaane Williams as public advocate in New York City, and through Tiffany Caban's race, changing the conversation around the carceral prosecution that had created waves across the country. So we see ourselves both as savvy, strategic election operators and visionary, progressive policy designers, really shaping an agenda that folks can feel bought into, consider us a political home, and see the meaningful changes in their lives when the government works for the many and not the few.
So, Shi, how large is the party? How many members are there in New York State?
I don't know exact membership numbers, to be honest, but we have several hundred thousand. We're a national party also, so we have national membership and New York membership, and we have a robust group of people who are Working Families Party registrants, who are active leaders in the state committee, who vote regularly on the Working Families Party line, is an even larger group. And then membership, right, we have a robust membership that extends, you know, across New York State, upstate and downstate, who participate in various forms, who pay recurring dues to the party, that are in the tens of thousands.
Do you know what part of the state Working Families is the most popular? Where does it draw mainly from?
I mean, we really are a statewide party, and there are strong progressive pockets, but the beauty of running a political party rather than an organization is that we really have to be and are statewide, right? So we have activists in Plattsburgh in the North Country. We have folks in Hempstead. We have folks in Prospect Heights and the Park Slope and in the Hudson Valley. So it is in our interest, and it is how we're building the party, to have strong pockets and to have strong potential for activists up and down the state, in suburbs and in cities. We don't confine ourselves to one geographic area.
Right, but it's probably safe to assume that where you have the most population, the urban New York City urban area, is probably where you might have most members. Just a thought.
We that's where we get a lot of our votes from urban centers. We also have a very active Hudson Valley base, right? We have that whole very progressive slice of the state, right, who are really pushing for independent politics. So we have very strong support in that corridor as well. So there are places where there are more votes, right, because of density, but there are also places where there's very, very deep commitment to the values and manifestation of those values in form of clubs and chapters that grassroots leaders lead across the state.
Okay, sounds like a very energetic organization. Sochi, I want to move a little bit more into the focus of our discussion today, which is that campaign finance reform. For those who in the audience who need a bit of background, I certainly did when we started this mission, on December 1st, the Campaign Finance Reform Commission presented its report to the governor and the legislature. The Campaign Finance Reform Commission is made up of 9 individuals, seven Democrats, 2 Republicans, who were appointed variously by the governor, the New York Senate Majority and Minority Leaders, the Assembly Speaker, and the Assembly Minority Leader. Their 140-page report produced recommendations that actually became law on January 1 although most of the recommendations will take actual effect in November 2022. Those recommendations, now law, include the public fund matching ratios and the donor contribution limits that Tamar enumerated earlier. It includes setting up a public campaign finance system that requires qualifying thresholds for candidates to get public financing. It requires the creation of a public campaign finance board within the State Board of Elections to administer the new stuff coming down the pike. It identifies the sources of the funding, $100 million being set aside for public financing, and setting new thresholds to become a political party in New York State. It is that last item, we guess, that may be most concerning to the Working Families Party. So I'm going to turn it over to Xochi, but first we are going to stop for yet another break and then come back and plunge in. Xochi, you with us?
Yes, I'll talk to you.
Okay. You'll let us know how concerning this is.
WVOX. Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, this is Nina here with Tamar and our guest online, Xochi Nemeka, the New York State Director of the Working Families Party. Xochi, we left off talking about the Campaign Finance Reform Commission report, which, among other things, levels some new requirements in order to become a political party. Can you give us your comments on that and anything else in the report that may have caught your eye?
Of course. So I think just to start off, in terms of what voters want, right? Voters have been asking for a meaningful look at a public financing system that brings small dollars in and limits big money, right, and the effects of real estate and Wall Street on our democracy and our elections. And similarly, folks in New York appreciate, need, and see the value of third parties in strengthening our democracy. And so when the commission was tasked to look at public financing, we saw it as a real opportunity to enhance, to deepen, to create a more robust democracy in which smaller voices, in which individuals have a greater say. And then when the governor decided to tack on investigation or exploration of the question of third parties or fusion voting, that directly conflicted with the mandate, with the request put in front of the commission to enhance our democracy, right? In effect, that undermines our democracy and undermines voter choice. This fusion is a key way for voters to be able to vote their values. And so to give folks a little context on fusion, in case folks are not familiar, mm-hmm. it's a really special system that we have in New York State, right? In the U.S., we are familiar with the concept of a lesser of two evils when people go to the ballot box, right? You know, it's a two-party system. It supports the idea that you choose a candidate and the party with which you feel more ideologically aligned, even if does not entirely map on to your politics or your desires, your ambitions. And if you're a third-party candidate and say you get 5% of the vote, that 5% of the vote could come from the candidate that you're more ideologically close to, and then that's what we call the spoiler effect. In New York State, fusion allows us to encourage people to vote their values and not spoil elections because voters do not want to waste their votes, and we do not want people to waste their votes. So it means that if one party thinks that a candidate is the best one, right, and another party, the Working Families Party, also believes that a candidate is the right choice, they can both opt for that candidate before the election. So we go to the ballot box and see Jumaane Williams, for example, on the Democratic Party line and the Working Families Party line. Mm-hmm. You can choose which line you vote for, and at the end of the election, those votes get fused or combined, which means you can vote your values and hold that elected person accountable based on the values that you've demonstrated through voting on a specific line. And so when the commission was tasked with looking at fusion, our first response is fusion is a constitutionally protected right in New York policy, right? Three times the Court of Appeals have taken up the question of fusion, and each time have continued to protect the right to fusion as a key way for voter choice, to increase voter participation, and to live out the constitutionally protected freedom of association for minor parties. So we believe first that the charge of the commission was unconstitutional, and we have a lawsuit whose decision we're awaiting addresses that issue. The governor and the commission must also have come to understand that it's unconstitutional because they moved away from an outright ban on fusion and instead moved to make it less hospitable, right, to create, to make New York a more hostile place for minor parties to operate. And so they did that in a couple of ways. They increased thresholds, as you mentioned, from 50,000, which has been in place, I think, since the 1930s, right, to 130,000 or 2% of the vote, whichever one is higher. And so we can imagine in a presidential year where turnout is very high, that threshold can get high. They also made it so that you to get ballot access, instead of qualifying every 4 years on a gubernatorial schedule, which has been the case, as I said, since the 30s, now minor parties have to requalify every 2 years on presidential cycle and a gubernatorial cycle. And fuse on the presidential line, which is another burden and another attack on the rights of minor parties and their ability to remain viable, to put resources towards talking to voters and to putting on an agenda rather than pushing for requalification every two lines.
Excuse me, Sochi. New York is among the states requiring the lowest proportionate standards for a minor party to qualify for permanent party status. You mentioned that the threshold was set back in 1935. Are the number of registered voters back then was less than half of the registered voters today. I think we have about 13 million registered voters in New York State today. 1935, that was a really different time with different types of campaigning, communicating, fundraising. Don't you think maybe it was time to raise the threshold to adjust to the current climate?
The fact is, as it stands now, right, we did a survey of fusion across the country. Our allies in the democracy reform movement did so as well. And New York remains one of the hardest states at this moment under the commission's recommendation to practice and exercise fusion. It's both based on threshold limits and it's based on the schedule to requalify. And in particular, in the presidential year, right, where Democratic Party electors have to agree to fuse or not fuse, so 29 people from across the state under the leadership of Chairman Jay Jacobs, who is precisely the person who is making an attack on fusion voting, would decide whether or not to fuse with the Democratic Party, to fuse the Democratic Party line with the Working Families Party line, right? So it puts a more concentrated power in a Democratic Party and makes minor parties...
It makes it harder for them.
Yes, right, of the Democratic Party. The threshold also is incredibly high right now. So we're jumping from 50,000 to potentially 180,000, whatever it is based on high turnout in the Democratic election in a very popular election year, right? And so another way that demonstrated this is a politically motivated attack is the fact that the public financing reforms don't start until 2022 and 2026, while this was instated this year in a very high turnout year. And so we can only put two and two together and assume that they're trying to make it very hostile and hope that third parties all disappear over the course of the year, which as organizers, this is an organizing challenge. We set vote goals. We'll reach and exceed the vote goals. But it is, by all accounts, through all measures, a very high threshold that makes it very hostile to third parties.
It seems like when you go to the polls, you're seeing all these different parties, the Right to Life Party, Tax Cut Now, Socialist Workers, My favorite title was The Rent's Too Damn High. The Populist Party. I mean, it seems like there's so many of these smaller parties. I know the Working Families Party National Chairman Dan Cantor said that raising the threshold would require minor parties to show substantial popular support. And he said it would reduce ballot clutter. Those were his words. That appears that he's giving some credence to the idea that a minority party should be able to show substantial popular support. I'm just wondering what your thought on that is.
Yeah, I think minor parties should be viable, accountable, robust engines for voter participation. And the Working Families Party has always been that. We have members and registrants who understand our value, who vote on our line, who see the effects of their vote, right, translate into public policy gains. And we think, you know, the what Dan is talking about voter clutter, there's a real truth to that. You don't want to increase voter confusion. There's somewhere between limiting voter confusion and outright banning the participation of minor parties and forcing all voters to make this lesser of two evils choice between two parties that may not reflect their values. So robust, real threshold, we stand in support of. People need to demonstrate, parties need to demonstrate that they have popular support.
Well, I guess the question then is, what's the proper threshold to demonstrate substantial support? I mean, the 50,000 vote threshold from 1935, and now we have the 180,000 threshold. Where do you fall between those two?
I think that is a conversation. That is a conversation that we've been willing to have, and that is a conversation that cannot be had in a context in which the proper threshold is seen by the Commission and Democratic Party establishment is a threshold that makes it impossible for parties to function and thrive. And so we're not attaching a strong numerical value. We don't believe that these thresholds and these limitations are constitutionally sound. And we also know that whatever the thresholds are, we'll continue to fight and make sure that we meet and we reach them. But
Soji, I'm afraid that we have to wrap this up. But it was a pleasure speaking with you, and hopefully we can do this again. The very, very enlightening.
Thank you, Soji.
Bye-bye.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, this is Nina, and Tamar and I have just been discussing how fascinating and enlightening our political discussion with our guest has been, and wish to heck we had more time. Thank you again. Our guest was Soji Nemeka, who is the new director of the New York State Working Families Party. We do have now more than a couple of announcements from the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle directly to our listeners. Tamar, take it away.
Okay. So, as you know, we're going to have some primaries coming up, and anyone who's interested in a change of party affiliation, you have until February 14th, Valentine's Day. It's the last day to change your party affiliation in New York State. So if you're thinking of making a switch to a different party, be sure to do it before then. League of Women Voters will happily help you. Just reach out to us. Also, the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle has a number of voter registration events scheduled to make sure that we get maximum participation in New Rochelle. New York State's early voting schedule has just been released, and looks like New Rochelle residents are going to be able to vote in the April 28th presidential primary from April 18th to April 26th this year. That will be here before we know it, and the League of Women Voters would like to get as many people registered as they can this winter. And something that we do every year, regardless of whether it's a presidential election year, is we have voter registration drives on the college campuses, and we really need volunteers. So if you or anyone you know is interested in helping, please contact Joan Alexander from the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. And her number is 632-2308. I'll repeat that number. It's 632-2308. Please come out. You could stay an hour. You could stay the whole afternoon. It's great to get on these college campuses and get kids engaged in the process. And then, Nina, I think the League of Women Voters has another coffee conversation coming up.
Right. I'm going to the New Rochelle Public Library this Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. because we are going to see there our members of the New Rochelle City Council. I understand that 5 of the 6 members are going to be there as guest speakers to answer questions. And although I don't have any questions at the moment, I will make sure that I have a couple when I get there. But even more than that, I'd like to hear what my fellow citizens have to say and have to ask of our local leadership. Try not to miss this. It's a great opportunity to chat informally with your local representatives. 9:30 a.m. this Friday at the Public Library in New Rochelle, 1 Library Plaza, right near the train station, right?
Uh-huh. Right,
close
yeah.
to the train station.
The League of Women Voters of New Rochelle does these coffee and conversation events once every month on a Friday. And we usually try to get someone interesting that you might not otherwise meet. So I believe they have the schedule posted at the library. So if you come by for this one, you could see who's coming next month. I think in New Rochelle with the upcoming Martin Luther King Day, we have another event, Nina?
Right. The New Rochelle is planning a day of service to help us move closer to Dr. King's vision of a, quote, beloved community. You can find some wonderful and meaningful opportunities to sign up at the website volunteernewyork.org/MLK. Volunteer New York, one word, volunteernewyork.org/MLK.
Yeah, I have one other event that I think is interesting to mention. It's not a League of Women Voters event, but just as a New Rochellian, I grew up going to Hudson Park. And it's a beautiful park on the waterfront. And the city of New Rochelle's Department of Parks and Recreation is in the process of creating a comprehensive master plan for Hudson Park. The city really would like community input. On their website, they've put up a survey. That survey is live until this Sunday. And if you don't get a chance to fill out the survey, you can still give your input because they're having a public meeting on January 30th. At 6:30 p.m. at the New Rochelle Public Library. So if you'd like to have some input as to what Hudson Park looks like down the road, please go.
So let me get this straight. The city of New Rochelle is redesigning Hudson Park, and we have a chance to help.
Absolutely.
Artists, architects, parents with kids, this is your opportunity to, well, we hope, create the park of your dreams. Why not give it a shot?
Yeah, so, and it's a nice opportunity to meet your neighbors who care about the community. So, Nina, before we go, I just wanted to ask you about one event in the world of voters and elections nationally that I thought was very interesting. And in a nutshell, maybe you could tell us what's going on in Wisconsin.
Okay. There is a lawsuit going on in Wisconsin. The League of Women Voters of Wisconsin and 2 registered Wisconsin voters brought suit on December 17th to block the deactivation, that is the deregistration, of what could be up to 234,000 Wisconsin voters. The recap, I'll be as broad and fast as I can. In October, the Wisconsin Elections Commission sent a letter to hundreds of thousands of voters to confirm their correct addresses. The voters were asked to respond whether they lived at that address or to update their registration if they had moved. The commission planned to wait until April 2021 for responses, a year and a half wait, because when the commission tried this in 2017, it was a shorter wait, and there was a lot of confusion, a lot of anger. The deadline was too soon to be met by a lot of the voters. By December 5th, around 230,000 recipients had not responded, or the letters were unable to be delivered. On December 13th, a conservative group brought a lawsuit against the commission, challenging the year-and-a-half wait and demanding that deactivation of those 230,000 people take place in 30 days. One reason they cited was that the shorter wait time would avoid potential fraud, having someone vote using a former address. The judge agreed and ordered the commission to deactivate within 30 days. On December 17th, the Wisconsin League of Women Voters brought their suit in support of the Election Commission's original 2021 deadline. So now that you have the history, what's the point? What are the implications? Look, Wisconsin is a swing state. In Wisconsin, President Trump beat Hillary Clinton by around 20,000 votes. What if the majority of the 230,000 deactivated are Democrats? Major election implications, right? Well, Wisconsin researchers suggest that the majority are Democrats. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found out that of the 230,000, a high percentage are in cities and in areas with college campuses. This tends Democratic. More than half of the unresponded to or undeliverable letters came from municipalities where Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in 2016. The Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin reports that individuals who move a lot tend to be single, younger, lower income, and non-white. This also tends Democratic. So, Tamar, I realize it took me a while to get here, but the bottom line is voter registration and every vote matters, especially in a swing state like Wisconsin. And Wisconsin's League of Women Voters has set its sight on making sure that what happens in Wisconsin, including any voter deactivation that happens, will occur lawfully and in keeping with voters' constitutional rights. So this is a big deal in Wisconsin.
Yeah, like you said, especially because it's a swing state.
Especially because it's a swing state.
Right. There are so many factors that go into who can vote. And Wisconsin's an interesting case. Another aspect of that in Wisconsin regards prisoners. I don't know if you know, but since the first U.S. census in the United States, the federal government includes incarcerated people in population counts where they're imprisoned. And that's interesting for Wisconsin because they have a very high incarceration rate. And by doing that, it really affects who's voting in Wisconsin and where they're voting. So they call that like prisoner gerrymandering. So it's an interesting state to watch in this upcoming election.
Right. We wind up the hour with our eyes on America's dairy land.
Yes. So wanted to say thank you, Nina. And thank you, especially our guest, Soshi Nemeka, New York State Director of the Working Families Party, for helping us better understand the Working Families Party today, as well as some of the intricacies of state politics. Ballot Box is on VOX the third Wednesday of every month. Tune in to our next show on Wednesday, February 19th at 9 a.m. On behalf of Nina and the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, wishing you all a good day and good voting.